It is a rare opportunity indeed when you can have the president, the national president of our national organization, with you at a state convention. Everybody, probably most of the states, request him. We have for many years. But this year we've been really fortunate, and he is here with us. He always has something enlightening to say, and I look forward to hearing this evening great stuff. So let me, without further ado, introduce our national president, Dr. Mark Maurer.
I have marched to that music in the past. I have a few degrees, and it was used frequently for those purposes. I appreciate the warm words of our mistress of ceremonies, Mindy Fliegelman or Jacobson, depending on how you like to think of her. Carl has done it both times and both ways. So I think he might remember who she is. I haven't been to a New York State convention, Carl says, since 1992, and it could be right. I very often go where there's trouble, Carl.
Well, could we stir some up for you?
So very often when there isn't any, I don't come, and I sometimes go for other purposes, but I only offer that as an observation. We heard some quotes today from Mark Twain. My favorite one of his is one which is attributed to him that says, "It is noble to teach oneself. It is nobler still to teach others, and much easier." I have, however, given it reflection, and the reflection I've offered myself about it is this. It is worthwhile to seek to change somebody else. It is at least as good to change oneself. Probably harder. And as I think about that, I also think about some of the poetry that I find of interest. One is from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who said, "Day is done, and the darkness falls from the wings of night as a feather is wafted downward from an eagle in his flight. I see the lights of the village gleam through the rain and the mist, and a feeling of sadness comes o'er me that my soul cannot resist, a feeling of sadness and longing that is not akin to pain and resembles sorrow only as the mist resembles the rain." And the part of it that sings to me is the feeling of longing, a feeling that I've had for all of my adult life. Maybe there was some other beyond it, but at least while I've been an adult. I've been blind all of my life. And when I was young, I used to wonder what the world would hold for me. I would read the books and think of the high adventure that you could find there and wonder if there was high adventure, but imagine that it probably could not occur in my life. In 1969, I ran into this outfit. And I thought that the people who were part of it might have lost their minds. Because they said things that didn't make any sense. Or at least they didn't make any to me then. They said that I should learn about blindness. And I thought, I have been blind forever. I have lived with this day and night, week after week, month after month, year after year. What could there possibly be to know that I don't already know? What is there outside of my field of experience? And then they said, blindness cannot stop you. Misunderstanding may. The ordinary person can do the ordinary job in the ordinary place of business who is blind. And this implies that the extraordinary person can do the extraordinary job. And blindness will not limit your opportunity. You can do anything you want with very rare exceptions. Anything. If you will get the right opportunity and the right training and go find the circumstances that it will make it practical. And I thought this might not be true, but let us suppose for a moment that it is. If it's true, how wonderful will that be for me? And if it's not, at least I have to find out. I attended my first convention in 1969. I had been introduced to the National Federation of the Blind, but I hadn't paid my dues. I wasn't a member. This didn't disturb me, and it apparently didn't disturb anybody else. They just invited me to come and participate in it. The president at the time was a man named Dr. Kenneth Jernigan, and Dr. Jernigan had told me that he wanted me to come to the convention. He said that I would need to show people things about blindness and what they ought to do and how they should think about it and actions that they might take. And I thought, yes, I'll go help these people. I'd been around the organization for all of a week. And I saw him during the course of the convention. He was up on the platform. And there were some people who had come from some programs in the federal government, and Dr. Jernigan was after them, and he said, now, this program has been adopted, and the law which adopted said that you're supposed to do these things and these things and these things, and you're not doing them, and I don't know why you're not doing them. Why aren't you doing them? And I thought, go to it. Sick them. Get after them. They deserve it. Keep it up. Which, of course, Dr. Jernigan didn't need any encouragement to do. He knew what he was doing. And on the morning of the banquet, which is always until this next summer, the last thing before the convention adjourns, I saw him in the elevator as I was heading down to the session, and he said to me, "Well, have you learned anything at this convention?" It didn't seem polite to say that I hadn't, and besides, I had. I'd learned quite a bit. I learned that blind people could change things, and it was real. And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, have you taught anybody at this convention anything?" And I had come there to help people learn things. He told me that. So I said, "Yes, sir, I've done that." And that's also true. I had talked with people at the convention. I don't know that there was a lot of wisdom in those days, but some, maybe, a little bit. And he said to me then, "Have you been teaching more or learning more?" And I thought it would be impolite to say that I'd been teaching more since I'm so new. So I said, which was also incidentally true, I said, "I've been learning more." To which he said, "So why have you been taking more than you've been giving?" I did not have a ready answer to that question. I thought it was a good question, and I still think so. Partly you have to learn before you can teach. It is unwise to try to teach what you don't know. And yet, some of you will remember that I was conducting a meeting of the board of directors. Fred Schroeder was a member of that board. After the meeting had concluded, it was a Sunday, and I happened to find Fred, and he and I were at the switchboard, and he and I started talking about this and that. And finally, it came to my knowledge that he had never operated a chainsaw. And then I said to him, "Fred, do you want to operate a chainsaw? We have one here. We do have one. We have a great big fireplace, and we keep a chainsaw. As a matter of fact, more than one these days." And he said, "Well, he would like to operate a chainsaw, but he had a plane to catch." And I said to him, "Fred, when is this plane you got to catch?" And he told me, and I said, "Fred, you got 3 whole hours before you got to leave. You got time to spare." And he said, "Yeah, he would do it, except that he was wearing a suit. And he might get his suit all dirty." And I said, "Fred, have I got a pair of coveralls for you?" So we went down and we hunted up the chainsaw and we got out one of these big logs that we had there and we put it on a sawbuck that we had close by. And I told him all about the chainsaw and described all the pieces. And I said that this was the little trigger that you pull to make it go faster right here, and this was the chain, and if you touch that chain when it's going, the chainsaw will barely notice, but your finger will be gone, so I wouldn't do that if I were you. And I showed him the other parts of it, and especially he was interested in the kill switch. It seemed to make him nervous. That shuts off the saw. And I said, "Now, Fred, what I'm going to do, I'm going to start this saw, and I'm going to cut a piece of this wood, and I want you to put your hands where I've got my hands. I do not want you to get your hands off of where mine are, and I want you to observe what I'm doing, and I want you to learn how to do this. You are going to see how I handle this saw." And I gave him a lot of advice. So I started it, and I cut a piece of the wood, and he said it was awfully noisy when I shut it off and put it down. I said, "Yes, Fred, your turn." And so then he picked it up, and I put my hands on his hands, and he started the saw, and pretty soon he cut himself a piece of this wood, and he shut the saw off, and he put it down. He said, you know, there are a lot of blind people around here, and I'll bet they don't know how to do this. We should show them. Fred was then conducting programs in New Mexico of rehabilitation, and I thought, you know, I'll bet those programs will never be the same. They weren't. Fred said he put a chainsaw class together when he got back, and he said the trees around the center suffered from this, but the students did not. And there was a thing, however, that I didn't tell Fred. I told him later. I called him during the course of the week, and I said, Fred, you know that chainsaw that we operate? He said, yeah. He said to him, you know, Fred, until last Sunday, I have never operated a chainsaw. He said he was pleased that I had neglected to tell him. And some people hear that and they think, how irresponsible. And yet, I've operated many things. A chainsaw was one more. And when I think about that, I reflect about what I came to know at the convention of the National Federation of the Blind in 1969. And what I came to know was that we can change the outcome for us. We can, if we recognize that the thought process has to encompass everything that might be a part of our lives that we might want to do. And if we recognize that the limitations many people have placed upon us are artificial. And if we start with the proposition that we will change ourselves, that is the beginning of a change in society. We are part of society as much as anybody else. I was at this convention in 1969, and I met some of the people who were part of our past now. One of them was Hazel Tenbrook. She was the wife of our founding president. Dr. Tenbrook had died in 1968. I missed him, but I met Mrs. Tenbrook, and she was running the office in California where we were managing our magazine, the Braille Monitor. I did not talk with her that year about some of the things that we discussed later. But I asked her about blind people having children. That we talked about in 1969. I suspect it has been the topic of conversation at every convention. And she said that although there were some blind people who had children in the early days of the Federation, it was quite unusual, especially if both parents were blind. We talked about it at the convention. We talked about what blind people might be able to do. We wondered together if blind people could go to college, and we wondered if blind people could undertake extraordinary careers, and we dreamed together about what we might hope to accomplish. And we asked each other who blind people should marry. You've been to the conventions. This topic is not new, but it's interesting. Mrs. Maurer and I became married in 1973. We were at the convention in New York City. And I met some wonderful people at that convention, some I never knew their names. We were fond of one another, you might say. And we went out to get a little bite on New York City streets about 1 o'clock in the morning. All the restaurants in the hotel were closed. And we got to one of these little stands on the corner of a street. And it appeared to me that there were a couple of guys moving in on us. And I wondered if I would be able to keep my wallet. A great big fellow with a real deep voice came up behind me, and he pointed to the guy who was behind the counter, and he said, "Get them." And what he meant was, "Serve these folks now." And he looked at the other two people who'd been moving in on us, and they left. And I thought, this is the proper use of power. I never knew the guy's name, but I was grateful. He was a New Yorker. He knew that we could use some help, and he provided it without ever being asked. During the course of the convention, we came to the conclusion that we would marry one another, and it happened in August. I expressed the view to Mrs. Maurer when she said she wanted to know when we were going to get married, that we would do it as soon as we could. And I went back to the University of Notre Dame, which is where I had been going to school at the time, and I had a bride to go with me, which was a delightful thing. We hadn't talked about the question of the children. We got to that in 1984. And if you're realistic about it, part of the question was, how good were we at raising children? Can blind people do this? Do we have the courage? Do we have the skill? In 1984, I was then practicing law. I had worked for the government of the United States. I had worked for a law firm in Ohio. I had been the lawyer for the inmates of the mental hospital for the criminally insane. An interesting job, you'd have to say. I had dealt with elder law and been responsible for the Senior Legal Assistance Project. I'd worked for the Civil Aeronautics Board in the Office of the General Counsel. I'd been writing decisions for the Civil Aeronautics Board. In 1981, I set up a law practice in Baltimore to try to find out if a blind lawyer could survive. In 1984, Mrs. Maurer was going to have a baby. A delightful thought. Scary. The baby was born. It happened this way. I left for a case that I was doing in Idaho. I was on the road all the time in those days, even more than today. And I had a hearing on Monday, so I left on Friday because I had to get the witnesses prepared so that they could give testimony and I could just sum up and make the argument that had to be made in the court on Monday morning. And Mrs. Maurer was feeling fine. She was going to have this baby in a couple of months. And so I showed up in Idaho, and the next morning I got a call from Dr. Jernigan, and he said, "Don't worry, everybody's fine." This is not the way you begin a conversation. Our son was born, and we found that he was subject to sudden infant death syndrome. Sudden infant death syndrome. That is a condition in which the baby stops breathing or the heart stops pumping, and you have to know right away, otherwise the baby is gone. And the folks in the hospital said, you know, we don't know whether you can take care of a child like this. We may have to keep him. I was sensible of the problem, but I also knew that this boy was not theirs. He belonged to us, and we intended to care for him, and we were going to take him with us. They changed their minds, which was just as well, because they wouldn't have had any choice. We found that there was a system that you could use that was a warning device that would let you know if the heart stopped or the breathing stopped, and it had an alarm. Took a little belt and you wrapped it around the baby. And if the sensors found that the baby wasn't breathing or the pulse stopped, then there was an alarm. And we took him home. Having had a bunch of classes about what to do in case things went wrong, and after a day or so of caring for him, suddenly the alarm went off, and I ran over, and I wondered how I could manage this, and I found that he had wiggled, and one of the wires that went to the little belt had come loose, and I reconnected it, and the alarm went away, and this became a pattern. Day after day, he would wiggle. The alarm would go off. Day or night, I would go over and hook up the wires. And I was working then in the law practice. Mrs. Maurer, at the beginning, was caring for him, but she was back to work after a while, too. And so we would work during the day and come home at night, and then there would be our son, and he would want all the things that they want. Food, new clothes, entertainment. The entertainment had to do with one or another of us walking around talking to him or singing to him or rocking him while you were walking. He would never let us sit down. I could sleep anywhere. I very often was looking for some reason to take a trip so that I could sit down on an airplane and go to sleep. About 3 o'clock of one Sunday morning, Saturday night, take your choice. We had been to visit friends the night before, had been to a little party, and we'd taken our son with us. The alarm went off on the monitor, and I rose groggily from sleep and went over to hook up the wire, and they were all tight. And I thought, what did they tell us in this class? What am I supposed to do? I hope I can remember enough. And the first thing they said to do was shake the baby, and I could remember that, and I grabbed him, and I shook him, and he began to howl, and I thought, keep this up. You got to breathe in order to do that. And he was okay. And today he's 24. It's not the last time I've worried about his life, but it was the first time. In 1986, I was elected to the presidency of the National Federation of the Blind. I quit the daily active practice of the law the one where I went to court all the time. I have appeared in court throughout the United States, argued my cases in courts of appeals, presented testimony to judges and juries. And if you have the right client, the practice of law is a glorious piece of work. If you have the wrong client, get a different client. And I started trying to work to do things other than practice law, which is to say, to give direction and heart to the kind of people that helped me find a way to learn how to build my life into something worthwhile. But I continued with the raising of children. As I say, our son is 24 and our daughter is 21, and maybe we're almost done. When our son was about 3 years old or so, I was walking with him on the street one day, and I had a fellow go by, and he said, "Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that just wonderful?" I thought it was wonderful. Then he said to David, this three-year-old boy, "Take good care of your dad." And I thought, this guy's 3 years old and you're telling him to take care of his dad? You got to be out of your mind. But it's a comment that is made to children of blind people all the time. And the burden comes to be upon them. If they have the kind of generosity in their souls that you'd hope that they could bring out, they feel this comment. So I was going to go to New York. Our daughter likes to travel, and she said to me one time, "Can we go to New York, Dad?" "Yeah," I said, "we can go to New York." Well, you make these promises, and then you have to fulfill. Children expect it, and they have a right to expect it. If you don't intend to fulfill, you shouldn't make them. Sometimes you can tell them that you didn't mean it, and sometimes you can tell them, even though you meant it, you can't do it. And they will understand, but you can't do that much. So I thought, we'll go to New York. And I said to the kids, "Why don't we go after Christmas? We'll see the Rockettes. We'll go by Rockefeller Center. We'll see all the decorations in New York. We'll have a good time. Let's go to New York." And they said, yeah, that sounds fine. So the closer the New York trip got, we planned this in fairly early autumn, the more David began to be surly, downright unpleasant to be around. And I got to thinking to myself, this trip is supposed to be joyous. What is the matter with you? But I put my mind to it after a while, and I came to understand that he was worried. He said to me during the course of the fall, he said, "Who are we going to take with us?" Sometimes we take people with us places, you know. We take drivers along and stuff like that. And I said, "Oh, I don't know. Maybe we won't take anybody with us." And he said, "Well, we'll have to take somebody with us." And I said, "Oh, I don't know." And it came to be clear to me that he thought we couldn't do the trip unless we took somebody to help with guiding and such things as that. And I thought, that tires it. We're not going to take anybody. And so I told him after a while, "We're not taking anybody." And he became extremely grouchy about it. And finally I said to him, "You are going to New York." He said he didn't want to go. "You are going to New York and you're going to have fun. Get ready for it, because that's what's going to happen." But I knew that part of the problem was that he was afraid that he was going to have to take care of me while we were there, and he didn't know whether he was equal to the challenge. We got to New York. We went over to Rockefeller Center. I got directions from the hotel clerk, and we walked. It wasn't that far. And we got over to Rockefeller Center. And I said, you see the ice skaters? Oh, yeah, they're lovely. All those flags, yeah, you see the flags, they're lovely. See the Christmas tree? No tree. I don't see any tree. What? We're at Rockefeller Center, there's got to be a tree. What do you mean there's no tree? I said, no, no, we can't find any tree. David and Diana, both there, they say, little kids, they say, we can't find any tree, no tree. Some passerby said to them, look up. And suddenly they said, wow, what a tree, Dad. I've always been so grateful to that person, you know. I knew there had to be a tree there. I didn't know to tell them to look up. This is one of the disadvantages of being blind, you might say. Huge, big tree in New York City. We got through going to one of these shows, and I thought, well, we've seen some of the main streets here. Let's walk around and take a different route, see if there's something else to see. And I said to Dave, let's go this way. And he said, no, no, we can't go that way, Dad. It's the wrong way. I said, that's all right, Dave. We'll get there. He said, Dad, we're going to be lost. No, we're not going to be lost. We'll be fine. We'll be lost, Dad, he said. I said, come on, Dave. So we walked the other way, and he was clearly worried, and he was going, but he didn't want to do it. After a while, he looked and said, Dad, there's the hotel. And his worry that his old man might not be able to find his way around was gone. A lot of the joy came back into it, and we went to see some other sites after that. We looked at Macy's and the Statue of Liberty, and he had a good time, but it took him a long time to find out that he was not responsible and didn't have to worry about that. And it was a burden that had been placed on him by the people who told him to take care of his family, because we're blind. Nowadays, he and we find joy of each other's company, and we plan things together, but we know that we're each responsible for our own work and our own lives. And nowadays, I think about my own history in the Federation and my own history with my own family and the nature of what we are doing. Dr. Tenbrook was a lawyer, a constitutional scholar. He wrote much of the background of what we use now to get laws adopted in our country. And much of what he's done has also been used to create international treaties about disability. We have held last April our first Tenbrook Law Symposium. And we've looked back at what he did. And we've considered what kinds of changes ought to be made in the law. And I was honored to give the keynote speech during that time. And if I think back, I think how this organization has changed me, how I have accepted the change. Because I never expected to be able to be making recommendations to a room full of lawyers about the nature of law. And as I thought about what I would tell them, I considered, if blind people are different from sighted people fundamentally, then equality of opportunity cannot be a basis for the law. But if blind people and sighted people are at the inner fundamental level the same, then equality must be a part of the law that we demand. And part of the reality is that the law that we create will be the law that we decide to create. For we know more about blindness than anybody else in the world. And I imagine that what we will do is create the opportunity to make the legal system one which can take account of the rights that we have that should be a part of the system of our government. And when we do it here, we will demonstrate the way that it works and how good it is, and then we'll get it into other countries. I think about the United Nations and how I have been to visit them in the last year. And I think about the World Blind Union and how it is that we have put our minds to the kind of philosophy that makes us the people we are and created the opportunities in our country, and that we in the United States are the envy of every other nation in the world. The message that I learned at our convention almost 40 years ago, and the message that I gave to the lawyers this last spring, and to those in Geneva when I was there, is the same message. What we start with is learning from each other about our lives and our dreams and our potential. And then we take those dreams, we share them with one another, and we build together. Sometimes it is technology that we build, and sometimes it is a program, but more often than not, it is a pattern. And the pattern is the one that is the pattern of our lives, and the way that we build it is to challenge one another and to recognize that there is a challenge, and to give enough support to one another that we can meet the challenge and overcome the obstacles that are there. I think about this poem and the longing in my heart, and I think about what would make my heart at peace. And I know that what I want is an education system that lets us use our minds, a legal system that gives us opportunity, a recognition of our fundamental equality with others. And I know that we will not be satisfied until we get it all. What we need is recognition of the talent that we have. What we demand is the kind of legal system that upholds our right to use that. And then I think of the last line of the poem, one that I have always liked, one that Dr. Jernigan shared with me a long time ago, and one that he thought was worth remembering. And the night shall be filled with music, and the cares that infest the day shall fold their tents like the Arabs and as silently steal away. Because we share that dream, because we work with one another, because we cannot be satisfied until we have opportunity as broad and as long as anybody else. It is a joy to be back with you in New York State. I appreciate coming back.
Glory, glory, adoration, heart goes to marching.